All right, so thank you very much for coming to one of the few first Azure Talks as part of this Plugfest Protocol interop session. Today I'm going to talk about a service for Azure called Azure Files, which is effectively a cloud-based SMB file share that we released in preview last summer and has so far been gotten a lot of good reception. And I wanted to go into some of the details because in conversations one-on-one with several people, there was some confusion about what exactly it is and what exactly it isn't, because it is very different than what many of you are used to on-premise. And so that's why the first slide is going, this actually I'm splitting the talk up kind of into three parts. First kind of going about what it is and the basic functionality and features that it provides, kind of the motivation of why we did it and what makes it really useful, and then drilling down a little deeper into how it's actually designed and implemented and some of the interesting challenges that we came across. Okay, what in some private conversations, people have gotten a little bit confused about Windows Azure because knowing that it's, Microsoft Azure, I have to correct that now. While we do obviously use some of our own OS components, what you're all used to for an SMB server is serv2.sys, and that is not what it's running. It's a user mode service, and it sits as one of a peer of services that are deployed to many of our nodes that you connect to when you're talking to Windows app, when you're talking to Azure in general for different services. And it's completely new. It's designed to be wire compliant with SMB 2.1. And it uses, if you read the MS SMB 2 spec, you'll see a lot of times you're reading it talks about the backing store. It tries to abstract out the data model so that everything is in terms of just a generic backing store. And that's very much the approach that we did when we implemented it, was we're not based on a file system at all, let alone NTFS, which also provides some interesting caveats in terms of compatibility for some NTFS features, which I'll also go into. But the basic idea is that it's a user mode service that runs on Azure. It implements SMB 2.1, and it uses the already highly available and durable primitives that we have inside of Azure, namely blobs and tables, in order to allow seamlessly fail over when you have to connect to different nodes, because all the important state is all durably committed. In that case, it's very different than a normal serv2 system where it's all just in memory. There's a lot of items in our memory. And over the past many years, the past decade, serv2 has evolved so that it handles more and more dynamic reconnect issues, and it's been a kind of a gradual evolution. Whereas when we started on Azure Files, we already had kind of effectively a distributed store underneath us that was both reliable and durable. So this is kind of a diagram. this being the Azure part and you being the client up there, our names, the DNS format of our names, where you have an account name that you create on Azure, and then you create a share, which is a container. And on my resources page at the end, I have links to some great getting started pages that walk you through exactly how you create shares and how you enable Azure services if you sign up for an Azure account. And actually, just this week only, we've also set it up so that from the B25 network, you don't need an Azure account at all. You just plug into B25, and we have a share set up, and you can just net use and go ahead and party on it to go play. That resolves through DNS to a central IP address, which is our load balancer. It's per tenant. There's some aliasing that happens beneath the surface, so we can do load balancing, and depending on which area you select for your account, we'll put you on one of several tenants in that particular geo, and that all happens through DNS. And then the load balancer will then decide in a round-robin fashion when you want to create a session, who am I going to send this to? Which front-end node is actually going to receive the session setup, the negotiate and the session setup? And throughout this talk, I'll be using a lot of SMB2 language and lingo and such, so it helps if you've been dealing with SMB2, and especially if you've had the pleasure of reading MS SMB2 cover to cover, then this will be a little more enlightening in some aspects. The approach we took, and again, I'll go into this a little more deeply later, but just to have some context for the following slides, the idea is that in the front end, these are very volatile things. These are the ones that run our service code, and we're always updating, always changing, rolling out new versions, bug fixes. So it's an extremely normal thing that you're connected to a session, and then all of a sudden it just dies. The machine dies, and so we have to reconnect to a different node. And we need that to be absolutely seamless. So as far as the client is concerned, they see a small hiccup, but it looks just to them like a network hiccup. So they just reconnect, and then everything just continues on. And the way we do that is by dividing up our state into several classes. And what we store on the front end is volatile state. These are things that change with every connection, or that we can go and derive by talking to our back end. And then immutable durable state, which are things that have to be preserved so that we can reconnect handles. And later on, I'll go into some specific examples of what these are. In the back end is our fluable durable state. These are things like open counts, file names, the actual file data itself, and other things that often on a normal server are actually written to disk, but also are also just in-memory things, like an open count or a share access field, for instance. These are all things that we durably persist to our backstore so that it doesn't matter if the actual machine that you are literally have, you know, connected port 445 to just dies or blows up or anything. We're just able to connect to a different one and then seamlessly pick up where we left off. These are the current features that we have. SMB 2.1 was a preview that we released last summer. You create an Azure Storage account, and Azure Storage accounts has a concept of containers within an account. And again, at the end, there's a step-by-step tutorial showing how to get set up with Azure Files and how to get things running. And it's extremely complete. There's PowerShell scripts for this, and some sample code there as well to really get you going. But it's once you have your actual share established, then from the client, it looks just like a regular, you know, SMB2 share, which is why I named my talk NetUse the Cloud, because you literally just run NetUse or the equivalent commands from Linux. One of the key requirements, obviously, is that we had to be SMB 2.1 compliant. And what that means is that multiple clients just run out of the box without any modifications. And we've obviously found a few hiccups here and there, because whenever you implement the same spec in two independent pieces of software, you're bound to have little things that are either tweaks here or there. And we've been working through those as well to try to basically make it closer and closer so that most things just work. Because it's built on top of Azure's blobs and tables, as I mentioned before, the actual data is sitting as page blobs in Azure, and then we use tables to maintain a lot of our metadata. So what that means is we're actually able to go and simultaneously provide a completely coherent view using the Azure REST APIs in order to basically enumerate files, read data, write data, create them, and they completely interoperate with SMB leases, byte range locks, so that it looks very much like another SMB user coming in terms of how multiple openers and multiple writers to the same file interact. So in that way, it's very you can have an application that's reading and writing to via SMB, and then another REST application can come and modify that data, and it's coherent and there won't be any violations. So this is really an interesting value proposition, because it makes possible to go and have the same data being acted on both by a conventional file handle-based application. And then if you want to in the future, you can start migrating some stuff to REST if you think that's something you want to do. It's a really unique feature, and it's something that is very different from other file offerings in the cloud that we've seen. Demo. And so I just wanted to give some quick background first, but I think the demo makes it really clear, actually, just what's going on. It's extremely simple. If it comes up, VGA2. There it is. Yep. Also, in the resources at the end of this talk, will be an email address of one of our PMs that you can email in order to get these credentials by mail. For this week only, you don't have to set up an Azure account or VMs or anything to test this. Literally, just plug into B25 and then NetUse and have fun. One thing to realize is that this is a one single account. It's a shared sandbox for everyone, so play nice and don't upload social security numbers or anything to it. Just make a directory for yourself and go ahead and play there. But understand that everybody else is connected to the exact same share and can read and write and delete your files or stuff like that. So as if you're familiar with the Azure, you'll see that we have very long passwords, which is a storage account key. Base64 encoded here. Actually, let me make sure that I really got the whole thing here. Yeah. And so obviously this would be a hard thing to copy down on your notes there and type in. Yes. And so this is just basically it looks just like a normal share. Excuse me. It was Y earlier. You'll see later on, I'll go into some of the details. You see we have currently a 5 terabyte per share limit as part of our preview. Oops, that's not what I wanted. And so our file system name is Microsoft Azure File System. If you have any legacy code that queries the name of the file system to find out what attributes and capabilities it has, that could be an issue. The way you're supposed to do this, there's documented APIs to query the capabilities of a file system, like Unicode on disk and such, and that's how you're supposed to do it, not query the name of the file system. We've seen only a handful of people have problem with this. It's really easy. If this is a problem, you can create a kernel mode filter driver on a client that just basically changes the name of the file system if need be. Yeah, so this particular test cluster, the question was how did we redirect the IP address? The IP address I gave is not the one showing up on where?
Well, the NetUse 23 and then the properties window showed a very different address.
Yeah, let me take a look at that. This test cluster, if you notice also, I didn't do the normal account.file.core.windows.net. That's because this particular test cluster isn't running what we call the XLS service. So it's not doing some of this translation. It's just we were setting things up. Actually, we ended up changing our test server overnight. So this one's configured a little bit differently. 157. Oh, you know, I think what's going on here, I think that's... Well, it could be NATed. I was just checking on that earlier. Is that what it is?
That's how you redirect to NAT.
Well, no, I think Building 25 is doing a NAT. Is that it? No, that's not even it. Okay, I'd have to look at the... I'm not sure where the shell is getting this address from. Because, yeah, you're right, it's not the same thing that... Yeah, so the discrepancy between NetUse and the shell, so I'm not sure exactly where the shell is pulling that address from, but I can go ahead and try to get some information on that. So on this share, you can just, it's just a share, you can... And you have all the usual commands. It implements most things that are people consider part of a base file protocol. There's some specific NTFS features, name streams, things like that that we don't have yet. I shouldn't put any potential future tense on anything. But yeah, it's pretty simple. So let's get back to the talk here. I just wanted to make it clear how it really is just a share in the cloud that is available currently anywhere in the data center. This week, we've made a special configuration so we can use it directly from Building 25 here. We're not seeing it in the data center. We've just opened up a test share so we can do it. And it turns into a pumpkin Friday at 5 p.m. So this is some of the stuff I mentioned before. It's 2.1 currently, 5 terabytes per shared and 1 terabyte per file. These are just some of the limitations we put on it first while we were first getting started. Definitely, it would be desirable to have more larger sizes, and that's something that is working on. Some NTFS features. I mentioned name streams, hard links. There's in the resources, we have a document that lists all the specific NTFS features we don't support. If you have an enterprise application that's used to talking to both, say, Samba and an NT server, these could already be things that they might be trying to avoid anyway. So all the base, most common file system APIs are all supported. Because REST has to encode path names as part of HTTP, an HTTP URL, there are certain RFC imposed limits in terms of character set and path lengths. And in order to be able to fully share this namespace between REST and SMB, we made the decision to go and basically find the lowest common denominator. It hasn't been an issue so far. I believe it's 2,000 characters currently we limit our path to, whereas straight implementation is 32,000 characters because it's defined as a Unicode string in NT, and that's how it's sent over the wire. 64,000 bytes, 32,000 Unicode characters. And we have a smaller length than that because of these HTTP URL limitations. This is our current Linux support. And it's important to note here, when we say pass, this means that we were able to mount it, create files, read files, write files. It doesn't mean that we've gone through extensive integrity and compatibility tests and are certifying that it works perfectly. This is just basically the sniff test. I mean, did it come up okay? Many of these, we found many issues. Some bugs in our stuff, some bugs in Linux stuff. We were able to resolve everything on these particular distributions in order for it to successfully come up and run and mount. This will obviously be updated as time goes on as well. Okay, so this is the why, also known as the marketing slide. We decided to do this. Existing file IO is a model that's been around 70s or even earlier, the idea of opening a handle and doing IO with handles. And it's basically the paradigm that all applications have been written to until recently, especially if you think about business applications and vertical applications within a business. Everything is based on opening files, reading, and writing. And there are a lot of advantages to the stateless paradigms of REST, the ability to go and get really good scaling because you don't have any state to worry about. But the fact of the matter is, we're not going to rewrite 30, 40 years of mission-critical applications overnight, especially when often people that wrote them have retired from a company or not alive anymore, and they just need these to just work. And so what this allows is the promise of being able to take these applications that currently are running on-premises, talking to an NT server or a Samba server, and just literally run those in a VM in the cloud and have it just work. Because it just opens a file based on a path and reads and writes, and the application will get exactly, it will just work. And because we handle all the leasing and byte range locks and all the interplay between multiple openers and coherency, all those features just work as well. So it's a pretty interesting proposition to be able to just take your existing investment in commercial applications and just try running things in the cloud. And then because we have this shared namespace, what it means is if you, actually that's my next slide, but let me finish on this slide first. Minor caveats, there are things which are currently limitations, are some of the NTFS features specifically that I mentioned. There are issues with our authentication model right now. We don't support Active Directory, and we don't have per file ACLs currently. So effectively, that key that I gave earlier, that is effectively the super user key for that storage account. This is the way Azure works with blobs and queues and tables, so that it doesn't have per file ACLs yet that plug into an on-prem Active Directory. This is something obviously that's important because you could have applications that depend on setting custom ACLs per file. So this is clearly something that will be very interesting to pursue. These caveats, as time in the fullness of time, will eventually get less and less as we implement more and more. So REST is obviously a big thing. I mean, in the cloud, if you look at most cloud vendors, this is how they do it. With representational state transfer, it's like FTP. You probably are very familiar with it. It just gets and puts. So it's stateless. It has a lot of advantages in terms of being able to scale really nicely. That is difficult for a stateful protocol like SMB, because you have state, and so that's what makes it difficult. It's also powerful, but so there's a trade-off between the two. If you have applications that are very much geared towards REST, though, and you want to transfer applications to use this programming paradigm, you can do it really easily with Azure Files, because you can start with your existing program and then just piece by piece, little by little, transfer programs to basically switch from using a file and handle based algorithm to a REST algorithm, because it's the same data. So literally you can just go and transition little bits by little bits, and then the amount of manipulation that you're doing on data with file APIs will decrease, and the amount that you're doing with REST will increase. So it's a really powerful feature that is, again, extremely unique, and it's literally because of the way that we implemented it. And below here are just some list of the REST APIs. I'm not going to go into REST. is a whole nother conference of Azure, you know, how we talk to blobs, tables, and queues. So I'm not going to go into that. But again, there are, in the resources page, there's a lot of discussion on this. The Getting Started is a great top-level resource, because it has links to all the other, if you want to go into minutiae of how other things work. So this goes back to that my first diagram that I had, which talks about how you create a stateful protocol, a stateful implementation that is able to survive failovers and able to handle coherency between multiple effectively nodes, multiple servers that are supposed to agree on the same state. And this required taking state that was in the serve 2.sys, for instance, and in most conventional file servers, is assumed to be local to a server and is very often stored in memory, and effectively cutting it up, dividing it into different classes. We have the largest one, and by far the most common one, are these things that are important durable state that has to be committed before you ACK write operation or a CREATE operation if you're guaranteeing atomicity, which are just things like the file size, if you're extending a file, the file name, file data, of course. And many of those things on a normal server are just literally stored in memory. So we have to go in and durably commit those. Some of the things, and actually let me go to my diagram, because it will probably help. Some of the things that are durable, but they're immutable. So for instance, things like whether or not we create a directory or a file. That doesn't change over the lifetime of the object. So we can actually store that fine on the front end, because if it crashes or we have to update it, so we basically kill it, it's still going to be a file or still going to be a directory on the other side. If you're familiar with it, again, an MS-SMB2, there's a SMB2 file ID structure that has a volatile and a persistent part. That persistent part is also, it has to be durably committed, but it's immutable. It's not going to change for the lifetime of that handle. That's something else that we can also then leverage on by caching on the front ends. And in fact, we have to, because we get the volatile ID from the client, and then we have to convert that to SMB2 file ID persistent, which is the ID that we use to actually, that's unique across our tenant. And then other volatile state is anything associated directly with the connection, you know, the port that we connected on. These are all things that are just have to do with that connection, and that don't have to go down to here at all. And even credit information. One of the things that's not clear here is once you connect, actually do a session setup and connect and establish your session on a particular front end, that's where your session stays. This is an implementation choice. It could be done other ways with substantially more difficulty. But once you do that, then we can have things that are unique to a particular session stay on this front end. Things like credits, for instance, which do have to be coherent within a particular session. But once you disconnect and fall over, then we can renegotiate all that. Fluid durable state are, I have examples in the next slide, if you can remember this. So this is kind of talking again about what I just said earlier about things that are volatile and we can easily keep in the front end. We have this immutable states. Session ID is another one that is unique across a particular tenant that you're going to be connected to, which is your storage account is bound to. That's something else that is in the front end because it can't change. Once you create a session, it's going to be that. And if you're familiar with session setup, when you disconnect and reconnect, we get the previous session ID, and that allows us to locate that session that's been durably committed at state in the back end on the previous slide. Fluid durable, this is a really long one. These are all the things that share access, open counts, file names, things that in many cases are literally kept in memory. I mean an open count. And we actually have to durably commit that. So whenever an open comes in, we can't just increment a ulong in memory. We've actually got to go and write out durably commit 3 copies or some other way that we can guarantee that it's durable before we can act that write. So when you're looking at trade-offs of actually an on-prem server versus Azure Files, you can imagine that the latency involved in incrementing a ulong in memory is a bit faster than durably committing 3 copies across the data center, across update domains and fault domains. That takes a wee bit longer. This is an example of a problem that we had to solve and augmentation we were able to do to an existing concept of SMB 2.1, which is durable handle reconnect, because of the way we were architected, because of how our state has been cut up into different pieces and different classes of state put in different places and treated differently. In durable handle reconnect, it was intended to handle network hiccups. So something goes wrong in your network, the client will reconnect, establish a new session against specifying the previous session ID. And then when that handle is used, the client is able to seamlessly reconnect that handle. So the client application, in other words, above the redirector, has no idea anything happened. Right? Everything that we do is basically trying to make it more and more seamless so that redirector operations, so that a remote share looks very much like talking to a local disk. Things that you don't expect to happen on local disks, would like not to happen on remote shares either. And so all these advances are towards making it absolutely invisible to the application that anything went wrong. So durable handles were part of SMB 2, and when this reconnect happens, it's able to go and send a special command to the server saying, I want to reconnect this handle. And again, it was only intended to handle network hiccups. But since we have so much state stored in our back end, we can do the same thing for effectively, with a server failover situation, where our user mode Azure File Services service it's either crashed or a server has died. The literal physical node that you're talking to has died for some reason, disk failure, power, anything. Or what we do all the time are rolling upgrades. We're always upgrading, and so we'll intentionally go and just kill services because we need to go and update the bits that it's running, and this happens all the time. And it would be not very tenable if, out of the blue, all the time your handles kept on getting closed. That would be very bad. So what we were able to do is leverage the existing protocol as defined by SMB2 for durable handle reconnect and effectively stretch it. So as long as it's invisible on the wire that we're doing anything different, it just works and it's protocol compliant. So when we get a reconnect, if we know that, well, it's not on the node that we're currently connected to, we go to our back end, and the data that normally serve 2.sys would store in memory, we're able to go and consult all that on our back end, our durable connect, and then reconnect and reanimate that handle. So then it just starts working again. So this was one particular example of how we went and split up and our state into different groups based on the durability requirements of those groups we were able to achieve an extension of even existing protocols so that they have much more functionality than they were even originally designed for. So I'm going pretty quick here. That's it, getting started. This is the blog I was talking about. The top one is a very good list of step-by-step how you set it up. Again, it's only here this week that you'll have access to just plug in the wire and go. Generally, you have to go and create an Azure VM, an IS VM, and then you can just net use it from there so that you're within the data center. And everything on this link is geared towards that. That being said, it's very easy to spin up an Azure VM if you haven't. You just sign up for an account. There's a gallery. You just pick up one of the either standard images, or you can roll your own if you want. And it's pretty simple. The NTFS features aren't supported currently. Again, things I mentioned like hard links and reparse points. Some things we haven't implemented. I hate to say the word yet, but obviously it's a continuing process forward. Other things could be more difficult that are very NTFS-ish that might be more difficult to implement. By the way, on this line, if you're familiar with the XFAT file system, the features and characteristics of XFAT are actually extremely similar to what we currently support. EXFAT supports 64-bit file sizes, and for instance, long names, no short names, which is something we have, and it basically matches very closely to what we support. So if you've ever net shared an XFAT volume, you'll see extremely similar combination of features available. But you know, there's no soft links, there's no hard links, no ACLs currently today on XFAT. So that's, again, something that would obviously be very good to add, and so then it will take us away from XFAT. But just for today, if you think of it as an idea, they have extremely close feature characteristics. Today, this week only, 2 days left, red light special. If you go and email Jutang, that script that I ran, he'll email it to you, and then you can go and this week net use it from any you need. It doesn't work from the Wi-Fi because we currently port 445 is blocked on the Wi-Fi. You need to do it from your hardwired plug in the Building 25 network, and then it'll just work. And you go play. We encourage you that this week to go and run Wireshark so that if you have problems, if you see compatibility issues, it'll be much easier to track them down because we're here this week. So if you can find them this week, it's really good because we can hopefully get them fixed really quickly, and we can have an extremely efficient interchange of you find something, we can potentially even go and fix it and redeploy new bits. So the sooner you can do some testing, and network captures are extremely important, not just for the information they contain, because that helps debugging it because then we can look at both sides of it, but they have precise timestamps. If we have a lot of people all hitting the server at the same time, when we're doing our searches of our logs on the server side, we need really precise timestamps because we're searching over such huge amounts of data. And so a Wireshark scan will give it that to us. Oh, and a little hint, something: if you're ever doing Wireshark on a negotiate request, this is a little interesting. Whenever you're talking to a clustered system or multiple systems, there's always a problem of time skew. The client has a different time than the server. And then imagine on us, where you can disconnect from one node, one physical node that you're talking to, and then bounce to connect to another one. And then your time is changing all the time, so you have different skews. The actual response from a negotiate request embeds in it the time on the server. So if you're looking at a Wireshark scan and you have the time that you got that negotiate response, look inside the negotiate response and the time on the server is there. And so then you know the delta for talking to that particular server. It's really useful. And then actually Wireshark even lets you can program in the delta, which then all of your protocol traces will match exactly. Well, that's for us, because then we can compare it directly with our logs. So that's a really nice tool, I guess, that we can use. But in general, if you're anytime you're debugging SMB issues on-premise servers, that's an interesting thing you can do. If you've ever had a problem of trying to match up exactly client network traces with happening on a server, you can determine the network bias, the time bias. And that's kind of the whirlwind tour of Azure Files as it stands now. Are there any questions? No questions? Yes?
You
mentioned that you mentioned doesn't support Active Directory, right? So
yes.
What kind of authentication is going on right now?
We're doing it at NTLM v2 currently.
But the account is local on the servers or something?
The account is it's the account name that you create with Azure. So when you create a subscription with Azure, you then create accounts, and you generate account keys, which we use as a password. It's a 512-bit account key. One more question.
Are the files you create over SMB accessible via other protocols from the Azure cloud?
Well, REST, yeah.
Right. So they will have the same name and everything like that.
That in fact, the fact that they have to have the same name is why we had to actually select a common denominator.
Restrict
for our
the character set.
Yeah, for character set and path length. Path length is actually the more onerous one. Because some of the weird, when you're encoding HTTP, you have to escape out certain characters. But some characters you can't even escape out. Whereas the naming convention over SMB2 is not even UTF-16. It's actually called UCS2. It's an older version of it because it literally is just fixed 16-bit characters. And so the redirector literally doesn't care about the content, right? It's just
a bit string.
It's just an array of U-shorts, actually.
Well, yeah, but it's like raw bits.
Yeah.
It's raw bytes,
whereas
raw
when you're encoding into a URL, it actually is important what you're encoding, and so that takes some characters out of play. But I'm really more concerned about the path length. Now, Win32 generally can only handle max path of 512 characters, 520 characters, but that. It's been known for a long time, and it's been documented that you can prepend things with back question mark back, and so using create file, you can actually use very long paths. And I imagine a lot of apps are doing that because it's worked since NT4.
And remind me, the share name was a container name?
The share name is, let's go back, it'll be easier for me. So this is the effective share name. Again, the account name is what you create. When you create your subscription on Azure, you create storage accounts, and that's the account name. When you go on the portal page, you get your account keys. And the share name is the getting started page shows you how to create shares. There's a PowerScript shell for it. There's some sample code to do it. And I think at some point, there might be a GUI interface to it, but I don't. It's in what? It's in the new portal, okay. So in the new portal, good, I'm glad I didn't say anything inappropriate there. In the new portal, it looks like we'll actually have a GUI way to do this as well. So no other questions? Huh, I was expecting one particular question, but.
You
have to guess, that's right, isn't it?
Can you deploy VM from this file share?
You know, if in theory it should just work. I can't say if we've tried it. I don't know. Maybe some of the Azure test people here can mention if we've tried actually using it for deploying a VM on Azure files. It should work. However, I don't, if someone from the test team hasn't tried it yet, I don't know. If I haven't personally.
What is the protocol version that you?
Oh, it's SMB 2.1.
So, you can, probably, but it's not going to be supported.
I don't know if I'd go that far. I mean, it's just a standard if it is just making API calls. But it's...
Right, but the on-prem version is SMB 3.0 state.
Yeah, there are extensions to in SMB 3 other extensions that make that scenario work much, much better.
Well, thank you, David.
Yeah.
Thank you, Azure Files team, and Jason, as David mentioned.